This is Talking History. Talking History is a weekly radio program focusing on history. It examines our past and how we recall it, how we preserve it, how we interpret it, and how we transform it into myth. Talking History is a co-production of the University at Albany History Department, State University of New York, WRPI-FM Troy, and the Department of History, Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska. The era of Reconstruction from 1865 to 1877 gave rise to one of the most revolutionary transformations of race relations in our nation's history. It was a time of optimism, social and political progress, and reactionary retreat. In short, the revolution was incomplete. African Americans got the vote and black politicians gained high office. But then came Klan terrorism and the reassertion of white supremacy. In the following documentary, producer Curtis Fox examines the 19th century civil rights movement we know as America's Reconstruction Era. This program is part of a new public radio history series, The Past Present, that Fox, audio archivist Andy Lancet, and audio engineer Paul Ruest recently began. Talking History will be bringing you more of their work in the future.
Historians call the period after the Civil War Reconstruction. The South had to be rebuilt after Union armies had devastated the Confederacy, and the nation had to decide how to deal with 4 million former slaves.
Everybody knew what a slave was. Nobody knew what an ex-slave was.
I'm Joanne Allen for The Past Present, History for Public Radio. In the next hour, we'll hear from historian Eric Foner, who calls Reconstruction America's unfinished revolution.
Reconstruction is the process by which American society comes to terms with the consequences of the abolition of slavery. One might almost say that in that sense, Reconstruction has not yet ended. We are still debating these issues of race relations, of the rights of different groups, of affirmative action, etc. These are all Reconstruction issues.
On The Past Present, we take conversations with leading historians and add music, narration, historical audio, and dramatic readings by actors.
To my own knowledge, there was over 2,000 colored people killed trying to get away. After white people told us we were free, which was in 1865.
My boy was in there while they were killing my husband. He went to the door and a white man took him by the arm and says, "God damn you, I will fix you too."
If they makes a white man pay $5 for doing something today and makes a nigga pay $10 for doing that thing tomorrow, don't I know that ain't justice?
Eric Foner is a professor at Columbia University and a leading scholar of the Reconstruction era. He spoke with Leonard Lopate, a public radio talk show host in New York City.
You say that our understanding of Reconstruction has recently undergone more radical change than any other period in American history?
Well, for most of this century, Reconstruction was viewed as really the low point in American history, a period of corruption, misgovernment. Most people probably don't know very much about Reconstruction, but what they do know, they think, is that carpetbaggers from the North went down to the South and reaped the spoils of office for their own profit, manipulating the gullible and ignorant former slaves, and that eventually the white South, through organizations like the Ku Klux Klan and others, rose up and overthrew this misgovernment and restored what they politely called home rule, what we would today call white supremacy. What's interesting is, you know, that the historians are always changing their interpretations. There's nothing new about new interpretations every few years coming to the fore. This older view of Reconstruction is remarkable because it remained in place for half a century or more. And it's only, not in the last year or two, but in the last generation that scholars have developed a far more sympathetic view of Reconstruction and have really shown that the old view was based, first of all, on racism, on the idea that blacks were incapable of any independent action or taking part in government. And secondly, it was a very partisan view which supported the notion of a solid democratic South, which no longer exists, and supported the notion that the white South should resist any outside pressures for racial change. So it really, for 50 years, was a bulwark of the old solid segregationist South.
Birth of a Nation can shock us today, but it had its world premiere at Woodrow Wilson's White House, didn't it?
In 1916, I guess it was, Birth of a Nation, the great film by D.W. Griffith, premiered at the White House with President Wilson. Now, Wilson, of course, would have been born in Virginia, even though he was coming from New Jersey when he was elected president. But he gave his imprimatur. He said, this is history written with lightning. He endorsed it. He was a scholar himself. And that movie, in the most vicious kind of caricatures and stereotypes, suggested that emancipation had unleashed blacks to rape and plunder white women, and it glorified the Ku Klux Klan. It was not only shown at the White House, it was shown to the Supreme Court. And when Thomas Dixon, who wrote the novel The Klansman, on which that movie was based, asked the Chief Justice, Edmund White, at that time, whether the court would like to see the movie, White said, well, I'm not interested in movies, and Dixon said, but this movie is about the Ku Klux Klan. And White said, oh, really? You know, I'm a member of the Ku Klux Klan myself. This was the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, so it shows you what race relations were like in the early part of the 20th century.
For the freed people, Reconstruction meant the opportunity for them or their children to get an education. Ambrose Heaton was a slave carpenter who cut the timbers and sawed the beams for the Baptist Academy in Talladega, Alabama. After the war, the building was purchased for a freedman's school.
It was a hard thing having to build that school for the white boys when I had no right to educate my own son. Then when the war was over and they bought that building for our children, I could hardly believe my eyes. Looking at my own little ones carrying their books under their arms, coming from the same school the Lord really raised up for them. I rubbed my eyes and said, Ambrose, you must be dreaming.
Reconstruction was also a time to search for long-lost relatives. This brief letter was written to the editor of a magazine called The Colored Citizen.
I have a mother somewhere in the world. I know not where. She used to belong to Philip Mathias in Elbert County, Georgia, and she left four of her children there about 23 years ago, and I have never heard of her since. I ask all who read this to inquire for her. Her name was Martha, and I heard she was carried off to Mississippi by speculators. If any of you can give me information about her, it will be gladly received. Reverend E.W. Johnson, St. Louis, Missouri.
Slaves were free. After hundreds of years of unspeakable brutality, the slaves at last were free. They were legally free, but that didn't mean they could do the things that white Americans took for granted.
In September of 1865,
one freedman, Henry Adams, describes the heady, chaotic first days of emancipation. Mr. Adams described conditions in the South during testimony before the United States Senate.
I asked the boss to let me go to Shreveport. He said, all right, when will you come back? I told him, next week. He said, yeah, you'd better carry a pass. I said, I will see whether I'm free by going without a pass. So, the next day I left and met four white men about 6 miles from Keechee, DeSoto Parish. One of them asked me who I belonged to. I told him no one. So him and two others struck me with a stick and told me they was going to kill me and every other Negro who told them they did not belong to anyone. Mm-hmm. But one of them who knew me told the others, no, let Henry alone, for he is a hard-working nigger and a good nigger, and I vouch for him. Well, they left me, and I then went on to Shreveport. I seen over 12 colored men and women beat, shot, hung between there and Shreveport.
In spite of pages and pages of similar testimony in the public record, historians until recently portrayed Reconstruction as a triumph of white law and order over black lawlessness and incompetence. Once again, historian Eric Foner in conversation with Leonard Lopate.
The usual way Reconstruction is defined is to call it the period after the Civil War from 1865 to 1877, but you say it began 2 years earlier with the Emancipation Proclamation.
I think Reconstruction does begin during the Civil War because the Emancipation Proclamation sort of made it certain that a new social order would have to develop in the South. The destruction of slavery, which was the fundamental institution of Southern life, meant that you could no longer talk about going back to the old Union, just restoring the situation the way it had been before the Civil War. Literally speaking, Reconstruction means new building or rebuilding, and Emancipation sort of made it inevitable that there had to be a rebuilding of the South. It didn't tell you what that was going to look like, the new society, but it certainly made it absolutely inevitable that there was going to be something new and different after the Civil War was over. It also, one of its most important features was, for the first time, it publicly announced that black men would be admitted into the Union Army. Some initial local steps in that direction had been taken a couple of months before, but this was the first public announcement that now blacks are going to be in the Army. And by the end of the war, nearly 200,000 black men served in the Army and Navy, and their service, more than anything else, put the question of black citizenship on the agenda of the nation. What was the nation's responsibility to them for fighting and dying to save the Union?
Lincoln had a plan for Reconstruction that he proposed at the end of 1863, the 10% plan. What was that like?
Well, Lincoln did come forward with a plan of Reconstruction, but Lincoln was a tremendous pragmatist and also a man of great capacity for growth. The 10% plan was a way of establishing governments in Confederate states during the war. And he said if 10% of basically the white voters signed up as loyal to the Union, they could set up a new government. Now, he left blacks out of the picture, but this was not a blueprint for the post-war South. This was an attempt to win the war. If he could detach a state from the Confederacy, this would be a great victory for the Union. By the end of his life, in fact, in his last speech, although he didn't know it was his last speech, of course, Lincoln said he now favored giving the right to vote to at least some black Southerners, particularly those who had served in the Army and those who had had some education. So he had changed considerably from an all-white vision of Reconstruction to one in which at least some blacks would be taking part in government.
John Wilkes Booth, he moves down the aisle he had measured once before. He passes Lincoln's bodyguard and nodding at the door. He holds a dagger in his right hand, a pistol in his left. He shoots poor Lincoln in the temple, and he sends his soul to rest.
You're listening to The Past Present, History for Public Radio. I'm Joanne Allen. Our program features conversations with leading historians, accompanied by music, historical audio, and dramatic readings by actors. Today's program is America's Reconstruction on PRI, Public Radio International.
John Wilkes Booth in his last play, all dressed in broadcloth deep. He gallops down the alleyway, I hear those horses' feet. Poor Lincoln then was heard to say, and all has gone to rest. Of all the actors in this town, I loved Booth the best.
Abraham Lincoln died only a few weeks after the Civil War ended. Lincoln's successor was his vice president, Andrew Johnson.
Johnson, I think, was very responsible for two contradictory things. One, the failure of his own Reconstruction program, because he was so stubborn and so racist and intransigent that he could not...
You say he was a racist?
Well, absolutely. Johnson made some of the most racist public statements any president has ever made. And in one of his addresses to Congress, he said that blacks are relapsing into barbarism and they have no capacity for government anywhere in the world. He kept insisting that giving rights to blacks somehow takes them away from whites, as if there's some fixed number of rights, and if you increase one person's rights, you diminish others. His private secretary, Colonel Moore, in his diary, he said something like, Johnson has exhibited the greatest prejudice against blacks. He saw some black men working on construction projects in Washington, and he said, what, have they fired all the whites to hire these black men? He was a Southerner. He was not a, he had a few slaves before the war, but he was mostly a representative of poorer whites, but he held very deeply these racist views, which were not uncommon in 19th century America. But that made him incapable of understanding that most white Northerners by this time thought that blacks must be given some basic rights as a consequence of the abolition of slavery.
Still, he called himself the black people's Moses, didn't he?
At the end of 1864, he was military governor of Tennessee, and he gave a speech saying, I will lead you, if you can't become free by yourself, I will be your Moses and lead you into the promised land of freedom. He did say that, but his conception of freedom for blacks was extremely limited. What he thought they should do after they were slaves was simply go back to work on the plantations and have no interest in public affairs. And most blacks thought freedom meant something more than that.
And he vetoed his own party's, or the Republican Party's, Civil Rights Act of 1866.
He vetoed many bills relating to Reconstruction, the Freedmen's Bureau Bill, the Civil Rights Bill, others, and these were passed over his veto. The Civil Rights Bill of 1866 was the first significant law in American history to be passed over the veto of a president. And Johnson should have realized that if two-thirds of Congress passes a major bill over his veto, that he's a little bit out of the loop, a little bit out of touch, and he should have tried to compromise. But Johnson was temperamentally incapable of compromise, and that doomed him because politics is the art of the possible, and Johnson just took his position, stuck with it, and he didn't care at all what Congress said.
There were other matters to be dealt with. Should ex-Confederates be re-enfranchised, or should they be enfranchised? Should blacks be given the vote?
Well, you know, vis-a-vis ex-Confederates, it's interesting. The old view of Reconstruction was based on the idea that the North was vindictive and punished the South severely. I think if you look at what happened after the Civil War, you might actually say that the leniency of the North was unbelievable. Only a few high-ranking Southern officials were arrested, Jefferson Davis, and most of them were released without even being put on trial. Land was not confiscated. The vast majority of Confederates were given the right to vote right back again. It was held up for a few years. Only one man was executed after this war, and that was the commander of Andersonville Prison for the death of thousands of Union prisoners of war there. But the whole assumption was that these states would come back into the Union and that ex-Confederates would regain their rights within the United States, but not the right to own slaves, obviously.
General Sherman promised and distributed land, that famous 40 acres and a mule. Johnson took that all back as well?
At the end of the Civil War, there were some tens of thousands of black former slaves who had been given land by the federal government. Sherman distributed 40-acre plots to many blacks in Georgia and South Carolina. The Freedmen's Bureau, which was an agency set up by the federal government, gave out land in some areas. But Johnson ordered all that land restored. He said if a Southern landowner gets pardoned by the government, that includes getting your land back. So it was a very poignant and tragic situation that many blacks who had been settled on land by the army now were evicted from the land by the same army at the end of 1865, unless they agreed to sign contracts to work as laborers for these white landowners. They were thrown off the land, and many of them felt a tremendous sense of betrayal.
I went to the boss at the commissary store. Folks all starving, please don't close your door. Want more food, a little more time to pay. Boss man left and walked away. A great God Almighty, folks feeling bad. Lost everything they ever had. A great God Almighty, folks feeling bad. Lost everything they ever had. Landlord coming round when the rent is due. You ain't got the money, take your home from you. Take your mule and horse, even take your cow. Says get off of my land, you no good, no how. A great God Almighty, folks feeling bad, lost everything they ever had. A great God Almighty, folks feeling bad, lost everything they ever had.
You say you have emancipated us. You have, and I thank you for it. But what is your emancipation?
The words of ex-slave Frederick Douglass.
When you turned us loose, you gave us no acres. You turned us loose to the sky, to the storm, to the whirlwind. And worst of all, you turned us loose to the wrath of our infuriated masters.
Many white landowners did not comply with the contracts they signed with black laborers. Henry Adams later explained this phenomenon in testimony before the United States Senate.
I picked cotton on Foster Plantation, and I seen the white men that weighed the cotton. When the draft weighed 75 pounds, they would check 50 pounds. I worked on James Hollingworth's plantation, and the same thing was practiced on that place. On Dr. Vance's plantation, where I often work, I've seen the same. From the mouth of the Red River to Jefferson, Texas, no difference can be seen. Oh, even in Arkansas and Texas, where I have traveled, I see the same, as it was my business to look around and ascertain as far as possible into the treatment of colored people by whites. In going to Shreveport to New Orleans, I seen along the banks of the Red River colored people who were afraid to talk to me at landings. I asked several of them, "Do you not live well?" They told me, "No. The whites take all we make, and if we say anything about our rights, they beat us." So I told them, "If the men you all live with this year do not give you all what belonged to you, just like he's promised, you all must leave that place and go to another. And if he does not fulfill his contract, leave that place also." Well, then they told me, "If we do that, we'll be all the time going from plantation to plantation, for all the white men are alike on this Red River. What one of them says to us, they all say. And what one of them do to us, they all do. We have been working hard since the surrender and have not got anything."
Johnson in 1865 basically set up new governments in the South based purely on white voting. No blacks had any role in that. This is what's called presidential reconstruction. Those new governments in the South passed these black codes, which were laws regulating the former slaves. And basically, they tried to put the blacks in a status as close to slavery as possible. They recognized certain rights. They recognized that their marriages would have legal standing, which of course wasn't the case under slavery. They said they had the right to own property, but they didn't give them the right to vote. They didn't give them the right to testify in court. They didn't give them the right to sue white people over contracts or anything. And they said that every black person had to sign a yearly labor contract. Now, poor whites didn't have to do that, but if a black person didn't sign a contract to labor for a year for a white person every year, they would be deemed a vagrant and fined or thrown in jail or just leased out to a white person who would pay for them. So it was really an attempt to use the power of the state governments to get these former slaves back to work on the plantations. But Northerners said this is not freedom. This is an attempt to put slavery back in another guise. And these laws were overturned, but they discredited Johnson's governments. They discredited Johnson's policies because they suggested that if given a free hand, as Johnson wanted to do, the white South would just act in a way which didn't recognize the reality of emancipation.
And the Civil Rights Act of 1866 was meant to undo some of those codes?
The Civil Rights Act was meant to overturn the black codes because it said specifically that no state could treat one class of citizens differently than another, but it also was the first law which actually stated who is a citizen of the United States. It established for the first time this principle of birthright citizenship. Any person born in the United States is a citizen. Today we take this for granted, but it was not true before the Civil War. The Dred Scott decision in 1857 had said no black person can be a citizen, whether they're born here or not. It was the Civil Rights Act which established the principle of black citizenship, which Johnson opposed. He vetoed it partly because he said blacks should not be citizens of the United States.
There were people who claimed that part of the problem was a labor shortage in the South.
There was a labor shortage after the Civil War for many reasons. One was a lot of people had gotten killed in the Civil War, black and white. Many slaves had left the plantations. But the main reason there was a labor shortage was that what whites meant by a labor shortage was not that there weren't enough people around. It was that there weren't enough people willing to work as if they were still slaves. When they talk about a labor shortage, they meant people willing to go to work at sun up and work until sundown for virtually nothing. Blacks were demanding pay. They were demanding control over their own economic resources. Many black women didn't want to work in the fields anymore. Blacks wanted to send their children to school rather than to put them in the fields. So naturally, there's a labor shortage, but it's not just a numerical question. It's a question of economic power and who's going to determine the conditions under which people are working.
And the sharecropping system developed out of this because it at least offered a degree of independence for the blacks?
Well, sharecropping, which, as the name suggests, is a system where there is a tenant on a plot of land, and at the end of the year, they literally share the crop. The owner takes half of the land, takes half, and the laborer takes half, or something like that. Sharecropping was a compromise. Blacks wanted to own the land themselves. They didn't want to work for whites, but that didn't happen. Whites wanted them to work in gangs under white supervision, just as under slavery, but blacks refused. They didn't want to be slaves again. Sharecropping was a compromise because each family got its own piece of land. They didn't own it, but they had control over their day-to-day labor. They didn't have an overseer with a whip driving them as they did under slavery. They worked more or less autonomously, and at the end of the year, the crop was divided. It started out as a vaguely reasonable system, but very quickly it turned into a system of perpetual debt and poverty because in order to grow the crop, you had to, in effect, borrow money for the course of the year, and the merchants charged such exorbitant interest rates, and often there was fraud as well, that at the end of the year, the sharecropper often found himself still in debt. Even after he sold his cotton, he still hadn't paid back what he owed the merchant, and therefore he goes into the next year further in debt. And instead of accumulating and moving up the social scale, he falls further and further behind as the years go on. So sharecropping kind of locks, in the end, locks blacks into a status of agricultural poverty in the South because of the credit system that it's associated with. But at the beginning, as I said, it was really a compromise in which many blacks preferred it to wage labor under an overseer.
Historian Eric Foner in conversation with Leonard Lopate. You're listening to America's Reconstruction on PRI, Public Radio International. During the Reconstruction era, many freed people quickly realized that in spite of emancipation, there were two very different standards of justice, one for blacks and another one for whites. One man's words at a meeting in North Carolina were published in The Nation magazine.
Yes, we are ignorant. I am ignorant, and they say all niggas is. They say we don't know what the word Constitution means. But if we don't know what the Constitution is, we know enough to know what justice is. I can see for myself, down in my own courthouse, if they makes a white man pay $5 for doing something today, and makes a nigga pay $10 for doing that thing tomorrow, don't I know that ain't justice? They've got a figure of a woman with a sword hung up there, Mr. President. I don't know what you call it, but she's got a handkerchief over her eyes, and the sword is in one hand, and a pair of scales in the other. When a white man and a nigger gets into the scales, don't I know the nigger is always mighty light? Don't we all see it? Ain't it so at your courthouse, Mr. President?
Once again, historian Eric Foner.
1865 to 1867 is what we call presidential Reconstruction, when Johnson's policy held sway. By 1867, Congress basically wiped away Johnson's policy and put its new policy in, and the big difference was Congress required new governments to be established in the South with universal manhood suffrage. Women didn't get the right to vote. They couldn't vote in any state at this time. But black men, for the first time in American history, now voted in large numbers in the southern states only at this point, and were allowed to hold office, and many hundreds, even thousands, came into positions of significant political power. So it's in radical Reconstruction that the Republican Party, based largely on the black vote, comes to power in the South.
Mm-hmm. And as a result of this conflict, Congress impeaches Andrew Johnson.
they impeached Johnson. Johnson is the only president in our history up to now who was not only impeached by the House of Representatives but tried before the Senate. Richard Nixon was impeached but resigned. It was never put on trial. Johnson was tried before the Senate. He escaped being removed from office by one vote.
And that vote was considered worthy of being included in Kennedy's Profiles in Courage.
That's quite right. Then Senator John F. Kennedy, in 1956, in his book Profiles in Courage, which, of course, he didn't write. It was written by, there are various...
Ted Sorensen, I think.
Sorensen or Alan Nevins contributed, but whatever, included Edmund G. Ross, a Republican senator from Kansas, who was one of seven Republican senators who voted to acquit President Johnson. President Kennedy included in that he basically based this on the old view of Reconstruction, that Reconstruction was a horrible mistake, that Johnson was the great defender of the Constitution, and that Ross was a great hero for voting for him. In 1962, when the riots took place at the University of Mississippi, when James Meredith became the first black student to enter the University of Mississippi, and two people were killed, and Kennedy had to send federal troops to Oxford, Kennedy said to one of his advisors, he said, you know, I'm beginning to think I was wrong about Reconstruction. Thaddeus Stevens had a point about these people. They will never change, and the only thing that they understand is federal power. So that the events of the 1960s made Kennedy rethink what he had written about the events of the 1860s.
I get the feeling that you would have made Thaddeus Stevens and Charles Sumner into the real heroes of that story.
Oh, I think, though, they are great heroes of American history. Stevens was one of the most principled defenders of the rights of black people in our history. There were those in the old view who said, oh, well, they just wanted to give blacks the right to vote for political gain. After all, they would vote Republican. This would help the Republican Party. But Stevens and Sumner had been defenders of equal rights, of black voting, long before there was any gain to be had from it. Stevens was a delegate in 1837 to the Pennsylvania Constitutional Convention and walked out, would not sign that document because it took the right to vote away from black Pennsylvanians. Now, there was no political gain in that then. He just was a man who actually believed in equality, and so did Sumner. And they were the driving force. They were the leaders of the radical Republicans. They were not the majority of the Republican Party, but they were, you might say, the cutting edge. And in a radical situation, in a situation of very pronounced change, the cutting edge often has an influence far above its numbers because they have a coherent policy in a situation of chaos.
By the early 1870s, there were quite a large number of black political officials throughout the South.
Well, one of the books I've written on Reconstruction is called Freedom's Lawmakers, which is a series of little vignettes or biographical sketches of about 1,500 black officials during Reconstruction. And that's not all of them. There probably were over 2,000. And this is people who range from members of the U.S. Senate, there were two from Mississippi, to congressmen, to members of the state legislature, and then on down to sheriffs and justices of the peace and school board officials and people like that. Blacks held office at almost every level of government, and most of them acquitted themselves very well. The old myth that this was a bunch of illiterate, ignorant, manipulated people is just false. It's just a complete misrepresentation of the historical record. And I think one of the most remarkable, dramatic, and really poignant things about Reconstruction is the way that so many former slaves, and indeed former free Negroes as well, stepped to the fore and shouldered the responsibilities of freedom, even at the risk of considerable risk, because many of them became victims of violence if they did become political leaders.
Many white Southerners felt threatened by the growing power of black politicians and the enthusiasm of black voters for the Republican Party. William Ford, an Alabama sharecropper, was whipped by Klansmen who tried to intimidate him into voting for Horatio Seymour, the Democratic candidate for president in 1868.
They asked me who I was going to vote for, Grant or Seymour. I claimed to them, as they had me overpowered, that I would vote for Seymour. I did that to get off. They wanted to know my politics. And I answered, what is politics, sir? Very ignorant-like. They had another man out at the same time. and they whipped him tremendous for talking politics. When the election came out, I didn't vote. I was afraid to. I thought if I couldn't vote the Republican ticket, I would not vote at all.
In the courthouse of Demopolis, Alabama, Betsy Westbrook told of the death of her husband, Robin Westbrook, who had made the mistake of saying in public that he was a strong radical Republican.
They came up behind the house. One of them had his face smutted and another had a knit cap on his face. They first shot about 7 barrels through the window. One of them said, "Get a rail and bust the door down." They broke down the outside door. We shut ourselves up in another room in the back of the house, and they got another rail and busted open the back door. One of them said, "Raise a light." I was sitting on a little basket on the hearth. They picked it up and pitched it in the fire. It had grease on it, and it blazed up. Then they saw where we stood, and one of them says, "You are that damn son of a bitch Westbrook." The man had a gun and struck him on the head. Then my husband took the dog iron and struck 3 or 4 of them. They got him jammed up in the corner, and one man went around behind him and put 2 loads of a double-barreled gun in his shoulders. Another man says, "Kill him, goddamn him," and took a pistol and shot him down. He didn't live more than half an hour. My boy was in there while they were killing my husband, and he says, "Mammy, what must I do?" I says, "Jump outdoors and run." He went to the door, and a white man took him by the arm and says, "God damn you, I will fix you too." But he snatched himself loose and got away.
There's so much mythology about the Klan, romanticism, even people who realize that it's wrong to go murdering your political opponents sort of say, "Well, oh, look, those guys were just getting dressed up in white sheets and scaring the poor blacks. Really, they didn't do much harm." This was a group, to use a modern phrase, of terrorists. They were no different than the people who blow up American embassies or IRA factions that blow up innocent people. They were no Hamas. You take your group today, they're like that.
They were the worst in areas where the blacks were the strongest.
Well, they were the worst in areas which were about evenly mixed between black and white population. The Klan isn't operating in like the low country of South Carolina, where blacks are 75% to 80% of the population. They're operating in areas that are about half black, half white, where you can tip the balance one way or another between the parties. But then again, that's a generalization. There are plenty of examples of, by the way, they also went after whites. They operated in the upcountry against Republican whites, assaulting and murdering them. They were a group of criminal terrorists. But
you say there were many prominent men in them.
Unfortunately, it wasn't just a bunch of young thugs, you know, the way misfits, the way sometimes historians would suggest. Confederate generals, lawyers, doctors, ministers were all involved in the Klan. And by the way, every Klansman had a robe sewn by a woman. This was a broad-based community activity, and it had a lot of community support. That doesn't mean that every single white person in the South was a murderer, but what it says was that they were so opposed to the notion of equality for blacks that they were willing to countenance acts of violence that under normal circumstances they would certainly oppose.
You said earlier that President Grant crushed the Klan in 1871.
They sent federal troops into South Carolina. They suspended the writ of habeas corpus, that is, allowed people to be arrested and held without charge. And they brought the leaders to trial, and they did crush the Klan. But what happened was by 1874, 75, new violent groups are emerging, the White League and things like that. And by then, the North is no longer willing to intervene. And so, like in Mississippi, you know, in Mississippi, when this violent campaign is taking place, which overthrows the Republican governor of Mississippi, Congressman John Lynch, a black congressman, goes to Grant and says, "Look, if you don't send troops into Mississippi, the Republican Party is going to lose Mississippi." And Grant says to him, "I could send troops in and keep Mississippi, but if I did that, I'd lose Ohio." And what he's saying is the Northern public will no longer support intervention in the South. And he's also saying Ohio is a lot more important to us than Mississippi. So you're going to be sacrificed.
Did blacks fight back against the Klan?
In some cases, blacks fought back against the Klan, but not that much.
Where they did fight back, what happened is the violence escalated and it became even more of a racial massacre. Where places like Colfax, Louisiana, where blacks fought back, hundreds were massacred, not just individuals or dozens. The thing is that blacks had little military tradition. Some had served in the army, but most of them as slaves had little tradition of fighting. Almost every white person in the South was armed. Most of them had fought in the Confederate Army. They were much better educated. They had much better communication. And anyway, it's not the job of the victim to suppress criminal action. It's the job of the government. If a band of criminals was riding around assaulting people in New York State today, you wouldn't expect the victims to go riding around and assault them. You'd expect the police to go and arrest them. That's the role of the government. But these governments in the South were too weak to do that. They didn't have the ability to, and so they had to rely on federal power. And when federal power was withdrawn, they were in a very precarious situation.
Oh, I'm a good old rebel, now that's just what I am. For this fair land of freedom, I do not care a damn. I'm glad I fit against it, I only wished we'd won. And I don't want no pardon for nothing what I've done. I hates the Constitution, this great republic too. I hates the Freedmen's Bureau in uniforms of blue. I hates the nasty eagle with all his brag and fuss. But the lion thieving Yankees, I hates them wuss and wuss. I can't take up my musket and fight them now no more. But I ain't gonna love them, and that is sartin sure. And I don't want no pardon for what I was and am. And I won't be reconstructed, and I don't care a damn.
There has been some red-handed work done in this parish that was necessary.
An editorial from the Shreveport Times in Louisiana, July 29, 1874.
But it was evidently done by cool, determined, and just men, who knew just how far to go. And we doubt not, if the same kind of work is necessary, it will be done again. We again say that we fully, cordially approve what the white men of Grant and Rapids did at Colfax. The white man who does not is a creature so base that he shames the worst class of his species. We say again, we are going to carry the election in this state next fall. Then let the Negroes of Louisiana beware. Whenever the Anglo-Saxon and African have met in arms, the result has not been a battle but a butchery, as it has been in Bossier in 1808 and in Colfax in 1873.
I'm Joanne Allen, and you're listening to The Past Present, History for Public Radio. Our program takes interviews with leading historians and adds music, historical audio, and dramatic readings. The program today is America's Reconstruction on PRI, Public Radio International. Once again, in conversation with Leonard Lopate, historian Eric Foner.
Well, you know, one of the things that it's difficult to quite convey to students, I teach this all the time, is that race, racism, these are historical phenomena. They're not always the same. They change. And by the late 1860s, most white Northerners, whatever they believed about people's innate capacities, believed that blacks should be part of the American political system. Before the Civil War, they had had referendums in the North on whether blacks should have the right to vote, only among whites. Blacks couldn't even vote on whether they should vote or not. They were all defeated by overwhelming majorities. Only 10%, 15% of the white voters would say, yeah, give blacks the right to vote. After the Civil War, they had referendums like that in the North, and they passed. In other words, a majority of whites had come to the conclusion that black people should have the right to vote as a matter of principle. Now, that's not full equality, but I think they were willing to recognize them as citizens, as members of the American body politic. And then they would find their own level in society, just as poor Irish people, they basically felt, were going to, you know, end up toward the bottom, but that didn't mean they should be deprived of all their rights.
What about in the North with the abolitionists?
Well, the abolitionist movement split in 1865. Some of them said, look, okay, our job is over. Slavery is gone. Let's dissolve. There were others, Wendell Phillips, for example, Frederick Douglass, who said, no, slavery is not abolished, said Douglass, until the black man has the vote. In 1870, when the 15th Amendment was ratified, giving black people the right to vote throughout the United States, black men, then the anti-slavery societies dissolved. They said, our job is over.
But then there had also been an ally with the women's movement, an alliance with the women's movement, and they were very upset that the vote was only given to men.
Well, one of the most interesting controversies of this period is the fact that the women's suffrage movement, which had been very closely tied to abolition throughout its history, now splits off from the abolitionist tradition because the 14th Amendment did not treat men and women equally. The 15th Amendment gave the right to vote to black men, but left it up to the states to disenfranchise women if they wanted, with no penalty. Actually, what happens is, to say that the women's suffrage movement and the abolitionist split is actually maybe not quite accurate. What happens is the women's movement itself splits. Two women's suffrage movements emerge out of this. One, those who will support black suffrage as a step toward universal suffrage, and others who say, no, this is no good. Black men should not get the vote until women do. And people like Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Susan B. Anthony begin to themselves adopt racist arguments and say, well, wait a minute, how can middle-class white women, the daughters of Hancock and Adams and Jefferson, be denied the vote, and Sambo here, the former slave man who is so far beneath us, is being given the right to vote? So with the anchor of the connection with abolitionism now removed, these racist views come out, which cause a lot of dissension within the reform community.
You said earlier that one of the goals of the Republican Party was to establish a base in the South through a coalition between blacks and unionist whites. Why did that fail?
Well, that's the $64 question of why a biracial coalition in the South could not succeed. Now, there were some states where blacks were basically a majority of the population, and they didn't need white allies, it seemed. But in most states, they weren't. A few states, like North Carolina, had a substantial white Republican group. These were small farmers in the hill country who had opposed secession and resented the old planter class and now saw Reconstruction as a way to end their own disadvantageous position in Southern society. And in some of those areas, they voted Republican all the way down to the turn of the century. But by and large in the South, I think the need, if you were going to cooperate politically with blacks, to slough off centuries of inherited racism, to deal with these people who had just been slaves 5 or 6 years before, now as equal members of the political system, was just too great a change for most white people to accept. You know, the power of racism was a very important barrier to the creation of viable interracial political coalition. One might say that the amazing thing is not that it failed, but that it succeeded to some extent. North Carolina, Arkansas, some of these states where you had these backcountry areas of white voters, you had significant numbers who were willing to slough off this history and work with blacks for common goals. That didn't mean they loved thy neighbor, you know, wanted to dance cheek to cheek. It meant they formed a political coalition, and all political coalitions are diverse. But so in some states it seemed to work, in others it never really got off the ground.
About what time did you lose all hope and confidence that your condition could be tolerated in the southern states?
We never lost all hope till 1877.
Not until 1877?
No, sir. In 1877, we lost all hopes.
Henry Adams described conditions in the South during testimony before the United States Senate.
Why did you lose all hope in that year?
Well, we found ourselves in such condition that we looked around and we seen that there was no way on earth, it seemed, that we could better our condition there. We said that the whole South, I mean every state in the South, had gotten to the hands of the very men that had held us slaves. From one thing to another. And so we thought that the men that had held us slaves was holding the reins of government over our heads in every respect almost, even the constable up to the governor. We felt we'd almost as well be slaves under these men. Then we said there was no hope for us and we had better go.
Well, we date the end of Reconstruction as 1877.
But black political involvement seems to end a little earlier.
Well, it depends state by state. One of the things that makes it complicated to discuss this period is that each state has its own unique history. In
Mississippi, it ends in 1875 when a violent campaign overturns the Republican government. But in Louisiana, in South Carolina, it goes all the way to 1877. And even the overthrow of Reconstruction doesn't mean that all rights are immediately taken away. There's a generation then from 1877 to 1900 in which there is some political involvement, but not as much as Reconstruction. It's not until the turn of the century that the Southern states disenfranchise the black voter completely and really end all prospect of political involvement.
More surprising, perhaps, is the remarkable reversal of sympathies that develops. Reconstruction starts being looked upon as a corrupt failure. In fact, The Nation magazine, I guess it was in the early 1900s, wrote, "Reconstruction seems to be morally a more disastrous process than rebellion."
This was actually in the 1870s they wrote that. This was a very good example of, yes, of what you say, this sort of a shift in Northern public opinion. The Nation had been founded by abolitionists in 1865. 10 years later, it is saying Negro suffrage is a mistake. We have to give control of the South back to the best men, the best educated men, the old white rulers. Right, this shift of sympathy. Instead, at the end of the war, sympathy is with the former slave as a victim of oppression. By the mid-1870s, sympathy is with the white South as being ground under the heel of misgovernment, etc., and corruption. So this shift in Northern public opinion is very critical to the ending of Reconstruction.
Most white Northerners during the 1870s and 80s had little or no contact with African Americans. Much of what they knew about blacks in the South came from popular minstrel shows, which often sentimentalized the old slave South.
In 1877, as part of the disputed presidential election of that year, when both sides claimed to have won the presidency, Rutherford B. Hayes, the Republican, and Samuel Tilden, the Democrat, basically, to make a long story short, a deal was cut between the two parties, the bargain of 1877. And the deal was that Hayes, the Republican, would get control of the federal government, he'd become president, but that the North would recognize Democratic control of all the Southern states. And that meant Hayes withdrawing federal troops from... Now, there is a myth that he withdrew all federal troops from the South. He didn't do that. What he did was he said federal troops can no longer have any role in Southern politics. He withdrew them back to their barracks, and then leaving it basically to the white South to manage their own affairs. So that's really the end of Reconstruction as a period of national policy of trying to protect the rights of former slaves in the South, and as a period of Republican Party government in the South. But Reconstruction as a social process of the country sort of trying to come to terms with the abolition of slavery lasts a lot longer than 1877.
How did blacks respond to the ending of Reconstruction?
Well, I think they felt a great sense of betrayal on the part of the federal government. I think what happened over the course of years was that politics became less and less important in black communities. Many leaders found other outlets for their talents in the church, in education, in business. Obviously, the church continued, the schools set up in Reconstruction continued, the black family, which had not had legal standing during slavery, now continued as a bulwark of black society. But public involvement became more and more remote a possibility for the large majority of former slaves. So it was a period of great disappointment and diminishing possibility. Some blacks tried to migrate to Africa. Some of them left, tens of thousands left to go to Kansas.
Why Kansas?
Well, there was land available in Kansas, basically. There were ads, come to Kansas, a lot of land out there. There were companies set up to encourage blacks to get land in Kansas. But So some tens of thousands left, but millions didn't. They stayed in the South.
How would you compare the situation to what we saw after 1948 in South Africa?
Well, you know, South Africa modeled a lot of its apartheid laws on segregation in the United States. South African apartheid, though, was different in this crucial respect, and this is why Reconstruction is so critical. Apartheid was a national system. It covered all of South Africa. There was no escape from it. Segregation, disenfranchisement, lynching, etc., were regional policies in the United States. If you moved to the North, you got to a different system. That didn't mean the North was equality, lack of racism, but blacks could vote in the North. They had basic legal rights. When migration into the North began in the 20th century, it meant that blacks were moving from one kind of racial system to another. And also, very important, the Reconstruction laws and amendments remained on the books here. They never rewrote the Constitution. What happened was a situation where those things were just dead letters for a long time. But when Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement reemerged, all they were demanding was that the law be enforced. In South Africa, you had to create a new constitution. You couldn't use the old apartheid constitution. They had to write a new one. Here, they said, we have these rights on paper. We want them in reality. So Reconstruction had put that principle of equality into the Constitution, which is very different than what was the situation in South Africa.
It had created the legal framework for future federal intervention in the South.
It had created what Charles Sumner called a sleeping giant in the Constitution, which would awaken. It took 100 years to awaken, but eventually it did.
Is that why, although most historians consider the Reconstruction to be a failure, the subtitle of your book on Reconstruction is America's Unfinished Revolution?
Well, yes, in a certain sense, but I think what I meant to say when I said it was an unfinished revolution was that the effort to bring black Americans fully into the mainstream of American life is still a challenge to our society. We are not living in the Reconstruction period. The problems of the 21st century are not the same as the problems of the 1860s, but that basic question of is this going to be a society based on equality or not is still unanswered. That's what I meant, that it's an unfinished revolution, because the agenda of Reconstruction has still not been fully lived up to.
Eric Foner is a professor of history at Columbia University in New York. His many books include Reconstruction, America's Unfinished Revolution. His latest is called The Story of American Freedom, a book that traces the idea of freedom throughout American history. The historical documents used in this program were found in The Trouble They Seen, The Story of Reconstruction in the Words of African Americans, edited by Dorothy Sterling and published in paperback by DeCapo Press. The documents were read by Michael Genet, Laureen Towler, Jack Davidson, and Peter Francis James. We'd really like to hear what you thought of this program. You can email us at thepast@banet.net. That's thepast, one word, @banet.net. Or you can write us at The Past Present, 524 East 13th Street, Suite D4, New York, New York, 10009. The Past Present was developed and produced by Curtis Fox. Research and production assistance by Michael Bornes-Ney. The audio archivist is Andy Lancet. The program was recorded and mixed by Paul Ruest. The interview with Eric Foner was recorded by Peter Zanger. Special thanks to Marilyn Groff in the Archives of Traditional Music at Indiana University. The Past Present is a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Funding for this program was provided by the New York Council for the Humanities, a state program of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Additional support from the Gladys Kriebel Delmas Foundation, this station, and Public Radio International affiliates nationwide. For The Past Present, I'm Joanne Allen.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You have been listening to another edition of Talking History. Talking History is a co-production of the History Department, University at Albany, State University of New York, WRPI FM Troy, and the Department of History, Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska. For more information about Talking History, write Talking History, Department of History, University at Albany, 1400 Washington Avenue, Albany, New York, 12222.